that pair of issues which has directly come before the court. Just for background information purposes, subsequent to the submission of the record into the appeal process, both the years 1998 and 1999 have been stipulated by the parties to be attached to the 1996 and 1997 case. So we're unable to tell you of any year subsequent to the first year at issue here in which the parties have come to a resolution of this case in any kind of amicable fashion. There are three issues which we have put forth in our brief. And to start with the first one, it is the issue gauging the inclusion of more than $300,000 of income derived by the owner-operator of the property from managing approximately 25 condominium villas, which are not located on the property, which are owned by others, which have their own tax parcel numbers, and which are acknowledged to be assessed at their respective full fair market value figures. Both of the parties in this case use the income approach to the valuation of the property. And as a fairly unusual circumstance in this case, the parties were even able to agree on the capitalization rate, an issue that is frequently debated between the property owner and the assessor. So this case truly focused on what is income and how should that income be dealt with. We believe that the record in this case clearly demonstrates that we have the very opposite of what was intended by that wonderful phrase, inextricably intertwined. We go no further than common dictionaries to deal with that subject. Our idea of inextricably intertwined income is income that it is impossible to separate from other income on the property.
Let me just interrupt you for a minute. You do agree that an income method is appropriate here?
Yes.
Okay. And so it's a question that this is off-site income. Now let us just suppose that part of the Abbey was rented out to, you can pick it, a gift shop or something. And there was a percentage paid to the Abbey of sales. That income, well, you suppose that the Abbey ran the gift store. Let's just take that away. Let's just say that they take a percentage. That percentage, I assume, would be part of the income revaluation.
Yes, I would characterize the amount paid, let's say, by the gift shop
right, to
the Abbey owner, whether it would be in the form of a fixed rental or in the form of a fixed plus percentage rental as rent for the use of the property. In other words, part of the Abbey property devoted to the production of rental income of one form or another would clearly be part of the income from the Abbey.
Well, isn't the Abbey in effect, you can call it a management contract, but isn't the Abbey in effect renting its facilities to the owners of these condominiums?
No.
That is, it's giving it availability to the swimming pool and whatever other facilities, including its ability to place people in there on when the owners don't occupy it. Why can't you just say that's renting out its facilities?
Well, we say it's not renting out the facilities, and I'd like to offer a couple of examples of my own. Let's go to the waste management case.
All right.
If, in addition to all of the facts that were considered in the waste management case, there was an additional fact. That fact was that Waste Management Company also managed another small landfill across the street from the landfill operated by Waste Management. and that the owner of that property, of the waste management property, received fees for managing the off-site unit, sending employees over there periodically to make sure everything was working and so on. Our position would be that the income derived across the street at the other landfill is income that has everything to do with the value of the landfill across the street, but has nothing to do with the value of the landfill. Now, the other example, if I may, we have in Madison and Milwaukee many apartment complexes and office complexes that are managed from a central location. I know of several companies in Madison that do it, and we represent some of those companies. We represent some of them in Milwaukee. And what you have is you have a central office for these apartment complexes or office complexes. It is the building to which prospective tenants come to make rental applications, to sign leases, to negotiate leases, to pick up keys, to pick up the return of security deposits. And it's the base from which that management company sends out its crews to clean an apartment or an office when tenancies change, to replace the carpeting, to replace the light bulbs, and to do all of the things very similar to what was done at the Abbey Resort to service the villas across the boundary line from the Abbey facility. If we're now going to have a system in Wisconsin which says that the service income derived by the management company for managing this series of off-site apartment or office complexes is to be rolled up along with the other income derived on the property from the property itself, we will be making what we respectfully submit is a major departure from our practice and our precedent in Wisconsin.
Is that where your concern for double taxation comes in, that you don't believe that it would be easily divided, income tax versus property tax, up in that concept you just described?
Yes, Mr. Justice. We believe that what is prepared on an operator's statement for reporting correctly under federal and state internal revenue procedures, the income derived from the operation of a business is different from the income derived from the operation of a property.
Repeat that.
I'm sorry.
Income derived from?
The income derived for income tax purposes by the operator or the owner of a business is different from the income derived by that owner from the operation of a particular parcel of property. Federal and state income tax law requires that all income from whatever source it flows must be reported and accounted for in one's annual federal or state tax return. When we are dealing with income derived from a property, we should not make the mistake of confusing the income approach to the valuation of a property with the income derived by the property owner from the operation of its business, which may include the operation of the property as well.
And that was one of the difficulties in the waste management case, because you are basing the property assessment on the owner operation of a business and the peculiarities of that business. According to the opinion, resulted in that decision.
But if I can just respond to the Justice's question about double taxation. We believe that under the bundle of rights approach, which has been well recognized in the appellate courts of Wisconsin, I think in the most recent case was the Continental case out of West Bend, which is cited in our brief. It is very, very clear that in our system, under 7032 sub 1, it is the assessor's responsibility to assess the fee simple interest of the particular property that he is dealing with. and it is, by definition, part of the fee simple interest that you must account for the entire bundle of rights. One of the bundle of rights, by definition, is the right to receive the income from renting or leasing the property. Now, what we have in this case is a record which acknowledges, without any equivocation whatsoever, that the condominium villas that are off this property are fully assessed at full fair market value.
Counsel, you seem, you may not be mixing arguments, but I need clarification. You respond to the double taxation question by talking about bundle of rights. Bundle of rights usually applies to the unitary tax law and not the double taxation, which deals with uniformity. That's the way it's set forth in your brief. So,
however, there's a crossover between the two, which is the point I was trying to make. If we are asked to accept, as this record asks us to do, that the off-site unit is fully valued and assessed, and that all of those elements that are part of its bundle of rights have been accounted for in that valuation, to then take some of that income and move it to another property and add it to the bundle of rights of that property, we wind up with not one tax plus one tax, we wind up with one tax plus one and a fraction tax on the second property. The effect of this, by having this doubling up, is to destroy uniformity. Now, whether it flows under the argument that it's a double taxation, or whether it flows under the argument that this results in a lack of uniformity, I have to leave to this court to find the exact spot. But if we agree that we have a unitary system of taxation in Wisconsin, and that these values cannot be split off, then what we have in this case is something which is split off.
Well, Mr. Markowitz, if I owned the condominium and was selling it, if I owned the condominium, the fair market value of it would be the assessment value, right?
No, I would say the assessment value would be the fair market value.
They're equal, okay. I don't care how which way you phrase it. The assessed value is the fair market value. So now, and the fair market value is usually the price that a willing buyer and seller are willing to agree on, right?
Right.
Okay, so I'm now, and I'm assuming that these condominiums do have frequent sales. Okay. Now, if I'm buying that condominium, one of the things that are attractive and will up the price is the fact that I can use the Abbey, that I can use the swimming pool, the tennis courts, the air field, whatever the Abbey has, right?
While I think you're right as far as you've gone, we must recognize that access to facilities such as spa, restaurant, tennis courts is always for fees that have to be paid by the user of the property, whether they're a guest at the Abbey or come from off-site.
But it goes into the fair market value, doesn't it?
The income?
The fair market value of that condo includes the rights to use the Abbey, even if you have to pay for it.
Well, Justice, that's like saying that people will pay more to rent an office building across the street from the Justice Department because it's very convenient for the lawyers in the Justice Department to work
that
way.
I think that's right, Mr. Markowitz. I think that they do demand higher rents, and the lawyers or whoever will pay for it.
So proximity of any given piece of real estate to another piece of real estate does affect the value. We do not have a system in Wisconsin, however, which says because the office building across from Mayfair Mall is very good and that the people have all of the access to go to use the facilities at Mayfair Mall, that Mayfair Mall's value goes up because of that. The value of the condominium, which has the benefit of proximity to something desirable, goes up. But that value, under our system, is captured in the assessment and valuation of the condominium unit.
Okay, so the condominium's value goes up because of its availability to the Abbey. We agree on that?
Because of its proximity to the Abbey, I'll grant that.
Okay. Then why do you think it's double taxation if the Abbey is then included in its assessment the management income it gets?
Because going back to Aberg in 1929, at least that's as far back as we went in our research, our state has said every property must stand on its own. And once you take something from the bundle of rights and move it to another property, we have to be saying at the same time that we are not valuing the fee simple interest of the property from which we've taken this stick out of the bundle of rights. If we have valued the entire fee simple interest in that condominium unit, there is no income that can be imported to another property's real property value. It can be imported to another property's operating statement for purposes of operating a business, but it has nothing to do with the real estate value of the property that we're looking at. We either value the condominium at its full value, taking into consideration, I assume, in addition to the market reflecting a value because of its proximity to the Abbey, I'm sure that when you go to sell your condominium unit there, that one of the factors that plays into the selling price and maybe the offering price is the fact that there is an income that can be derived from that property when you yourself are not using it. But all of that potential, all of that value, we submit must be captured in the value of the condominium unit. In this case, we did not have an assessor come in and say, he transferred some of the value of the condominium unit to the Abbey, and that between the two, they come out right. One is lower than it should be, one is higher than it should be, but the total is acceptable. In this case, what we have is a value on the condominium unit at 100%, and then we have a value on the Abbey, which is 100% based on the Abbey's property, plus an additional factor, which in this case is more than $3 million, attributable to the receipt of that income.
Counsel, though, if I were the owner of one of those condominiums, I would be jumping up and saying, hey, you're saying all of the income should be taxed to my condominium? I'm only getting 50% of it. Don't tax me on the other 50% that I don't see.
And the assessor should not be taxing on the other 50%. The other 50%
is
the other 50% in the view of the property owner of the condo is expenses associated with the production of the income. The expenses associated with the production of the income on the condo property leaves a certain residue of income to the property owner, which affects that value. But those expenses are not property income to someone else. They're service income
to someone
else.
I want to revisit your initial argument. And it seemed to me that there was kind of a blending of landfills and resorts rather than apples and oranges. You were using the argument that if you were a rental agency and rented off-site properties, or if you were a landfill, referring to waste management, and had an off-site landfill. But here we're dealing with a resort. I note that the Court of Appeals pays heavy emphasis on the view that the income from the management fees is generated not off-site from service, is not generated off-site, but is generated from services and amenities on the property. How does that comport with your hypothetical of waste management, as you used, or other management services that don't have resorts?
With all due respect to the Court of Appeals, I think they missed the point. When they talk about that income being income derived on the property, I think they have heard. I think that the source of the income is the off-site property. The only reason there is income flowing to the owner of the Abbey from the off-site property is because there are management contracts for providing a service. The service is the management of those units. The incidental things that the people are able to use at a cost to themselves is not much different than the public. Anybody can walk in and buy a meal in the restaurant if they pay the price of the meal. Anyone can walk in and use the spa if they pay the price for the use of the spa. I think we have to stay with what is the source of the income. The source of the income, the but-for argument here, is were it not for the contracts that the Abbey is able to obtain to manage these off-site units, there would be no flow of income to the owner of the Abbey. We're not challenging the inclusion of the flow of that income for income tax purposes. We are only challenging it for property tax purposes under the Wisconsin system.
Just for clarification, factually, there are more condos there, but as I understand, only, I hate to use, only 20 or 30 of them are in this management arrangement.
My understanding is that there are numerous condominiums there, and they flow in and out of this pool.
Right.
There is no permanent 20 or 25 units that are in the pool. These are, as the record reflects, one-year contracts. In the year in which I'm the owner of a condo and I have no use for it, I may put it into the rental pool. The following year, I may choose to use it, and it will be out of the pool and perhaps replaced with a different
unit. Hypothetically, they could have an arrangement with condos that were 4 miles away, any hotel could do this, have this arrangement of being able to use the facility as a benefit for them, for someone using that condo. So
yes.
It's kind of a floating status.
I think the test isn't how far away is it. I think the test is it a separate, assessed, at full value parcel? Once it is, any income that comes from that particular use cannot be deemed part of the income from the subject property that we're dealing with.
Mark, I have one question.
Yes, sir.
Remember the Deutsches Land case from a year ago?
I guess I should remember the Deutsches Land case.
One of the issues there was that the customers of the Bavarian Inn, lot 2, I believe it was, could use Old Heidelberg Park, lot 3, and there was no rent involved. Are you saying that the people who live in those condominiums get no free amenities from the Abbey?
They get such minor things free that we can't even tabulate them. The right to walk on the, to come into a public facility, to me, it's no different than if I go to the Pfister Hotel in downtown Milwaukee. I'm not a guest of the hotel. I can walk in. I can walk through the common area. I can go into one of the restaurants. I can enjoy a meal there. I can go to the bar. I can enjoy a drink there. There are all kinds of things that can be done. Now, while I'm in the lobby of the Pfister Hotel, I can admire the artwork that's on the wall, or I can sit on a couch in their common area and I can have a conversation with someone. We do not try to put values on these small items. In the Deutschland case, just to complete my answer to the question, which in our office we refer to as the Bavarian case rather than the Deutschland case. But all of that we were talking about was within the perimeter or the parameters of, if you will, of a given piece of property and what was happening on that piece of property. What was the activity? Was it exempt? Was it not exempt? In this case, we are dealing, perhaps for the first time, with what we believe to be an effort to extend the so-called waste management rule to start dealing with income derived off the property. Now, just two other notes before I finish. In addition to the argument that we've spent all of our time discussing, we have pointed out in our brief that we believe that the methodology used here by the assessor is in violation of the Metropolitan Rule, and we also believe that a methodology which assumes a value for a collection of properties and then arrives at the valuation of a particular piece of property by simply subtracting the value of the other properties to get to a residue is not an appropriate recognized technique under Section 70.32 sub 1. Thank you very much for the extra time.
Thank you, Mr. Markovitz. Mr. Hose, representing the Board of Review of the Village of Montana.
Thank you. Imagine that you're a guest at the Abbey Resort. You have a choice of staying in a villa, that is a condominium villa, or in the hotel main buildings. The rates vary, but everything else is the same. You make your reservations the same way, you check in at the same place, you look out on the same lake, you exercise at the same spa in the same recreation building, you swim in the same pool, you play on the same tennis courts, you dine in the same restaurants, you charge your meals to your room, you use the switchboard, you check out at the same place, and you pay your bill at the same place. This is not what anybody from the public can do. This is access reserved for guests of the Abbey. And there's nothing in the record that suggests that a member of the public can just walk in and use all the Abbey's facilities. What is the condominium renter paying for? Not just the maid service or the fact that the carpeting is replaced every few years. The renter of the condominium is paying not just for a place to sleep, but for access to the hotel, for the entire experience of staying at the Abbey Resort. Now let's suppose that you're the owner of the hotel. It does make a difference to you whether someone stays at the condominium or at the main hotel building, because if the guest stays at the main hotel building, you keep 100% of the room revenue. If the guest stays at the condominium, the rent is split 50-50. Well, what this means is that the condominiums function as a cash cow for the hotel. This arrangement has continued for over 18 years, ever since the condominiums were first built. This produces a huge amount of income from the hotel, over $300,000 a year. That accounts for 31% of the hotel's income. Now, if you're the owner of the hotel, you know that your hotel is worth a lot more because of this steady stream of income from the condominiums. The Court of Appeals calls this management income, but what this is really renting out access to the facilities of the Abbey Resort and not just the space in the condominiums.
Well, that was one of the points I was trying to get out. But it's not totally renting the facility of the Abbey.
That is correct, and that's why the rent does not go 100% to the owner of the hotel. It's split 50-50 between the condominium owner and the owner of the hotel.
But the expense of the hotel, is the net income split or the gross?
The gross income, the gross rent from the condominium rental is split 50-50.
But from the hotel's 50%, it has to pay maid service? It is to pay for the people who register.
Correct.
The occupants, the people that answer the telephone and make the reservations, etc. That's management services.
That's correct. And all those expenses are deducted by the assessor in calculating the income stream, the net income from the hotel.
So they've taken that off, and they have just, for assessment purposes, not income tax purposes, for assessment purposes, they're only, you are alleging or asserting that the assessment is based only on the rental of the real property facilities of the Abbey.
Correct. And the reason we're saying that is that the heart of the reason we're saying that is that the real property value, the fair market value of the hotel, depends on what a willing seller will sell the hotel for and what a willing buyer will buy the hotel for. Now, if you're the owner of the hotel, you're going to value the hotel more highly, demand a higher price because of the expectation that this income stream of over $300,000 a year will continue as it has for 18 years.
Let me ask you, this is the question that interests me. So that one-year contract, you say, has been on since 1978, but there's nothing saying if there's bad management at the Abbey and the people say, gee, the food is bad, the pool isn't clean, these so-called management skills, do you think that there might not be 20 or 30 people? There could be 5 or 10 some years. So this could go up and down. There's no guarantees.
There's never, in the hotel business, as in most businesses, there is no guarantee. A buyer could come along and buy the Abbey and promptly run it into the ground.
But that
is not the way that hotels are bought and sold. People who buy a hotel expect to be able to operate it in a reasonable manner and continue the profit-making history of the hotel. They don't expect that they're going to lose all their customers, otherwise they wouldn't buy the hotel.
But I would expect that the Abbey would be worth more if there was a 20-year contract with these condos rather than a year-to-year. So a year-to-year with a longevity is worth X amount, but if it were 20-year or 30 or 50 or whatever, it would be worth X plus Y. Is that right?
I think it would be, but the assessor did not include any premium for the a long-lived contract. If there were a 50-year contract or a 25-year contract with the condominium owners, the assessor could have included a premium because of the certainty involved there. But a one-year contract with a condominium owner is 365 times longer than a daily contract with a guest who can leave any moment.
If, in fact, the contracts were not renewed, would the Abbey be entitled to an immediate reassessment?
If the contracts were not renewed and the income stream disappeared, then the Abbey could say, well, we don't have this income stream anymore. Our assessment should be lower. An assessor could not count the income stream based on an expectation that it would continue when it stopped. Exactly.
Counsel, I'm sorry. Why not keep it simple? I mean, why not just say, look, on-site, you can take it. Off-site, you can't take it. And then you don't get into any slippery slope. I can come up with a myriad of hypotheticals. The Abbey doesn't have any water in it, and maybe it just has no tennis court and no indoor pool, but just has a spa and a health room. I mean, there are how many kind of units like that around the state? If you want to go to Madeline Island and to stay at the inn there, they rent out cottages, they rent out houses for folks. You go to the main desk at the Madeline Island Inn, and that's where you check in. They advertise the rates, let me say, hypothetically speaking, of the Varda Cottage and the Wimmer House. And so, How is that any...
But they have no pool. They have no spa. They have no in-ground or outdoor pool. They have no health facility.
How would you respond to that kind of setup and any kind, hypothetical? My bottom line question is, why get into this slippery slope?
Because economic reality requires a factually based assessment. It requires the assessor to look at what real buyers would sell the property for, what real owners would sell the property for, and what real buyers would pay for the property. There's no way around economic reality by constructing an artificial distinction between what's, quote, on-site and what's, quote, off-site.
Justice Bradley brought up some more examples. There are numerous examples other than those in this these two briefs that one could say, hey, now this building, because it's inextricably involved with a, you could even go into a farming business and say you're renting these farms and you have this extraordinary capacity to develop or produce the grains or whatever, and this would make the value of this particular farm more than the three adjoining farms, because that's what's happening in the farming industry. People are no longer farming themselves, they're leasing their land out. And you've got the same, quote, theory that you look, well, they have leased these farms, therefore this is a big operation, they're being able to compete because they're big and they've got all the machinery. This farm should be assessed more because they have that capability. What about that argument? Is that the way it should be? That seems to me to get into this mixing apples and oranges or not keeping it simple anymore.
Well, the point about the idea of something being intertwined with the property is that it is something that will be transferred with the property to a new buyer.
Yeah, these are only one-year leases, and that's what...
Well, what is being transferred to the buyer is not simply the assignment of the existing short-term contracts with the condominium owners, but the expectation of being able to continue a very lucrative arrangement. Just as what is being transferred to the buyer is not merely the reservations that people have made for future use of rooms in the hotel building, but the expectation that people will make reservations again in the future. Buyers buy a hotel based on their expectation of income, and sellers sell a hotel on the same basis. So it's a factually based question for the assessor to decide in the first instance, and for the Board of Review to decide if the assessor made an error, and for the courts to decide if there was substantial evidence to support the Board of Review's finding. So we're back to the question of whether there was substantial evidence here. There's no dispute that there was.
Counsel, I may have missed this somewhere. Do the present owners of the condominiums have a choice? Can, for instance, I buy a condominium and say to the Abbey, I don't want to have anything to do with you?
Yes.
Do any of them do that?
It's not in the record.
Oh.
But only certain condos are involved here. Was that 20 or 30 or something?
It is in the record that only some of the condos participate in the rental pool. But it is not in the record as to what the other condos do.
Okay. Now, you say that the value is based on expectation of income. And as I understood it, the valuation here for assessment purposes took into account management expenses unrelated to the use of the property that they made there.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Justice Bradley's example. Suppose that the Madeline Inn, or any inn, if I understood her example, if not, I'm changing it, offers nothing to these condo owners other than to book the facility, book the condo, and clean it. Okay?
Right.
Nothing else. Would that go into the property assessment of the Madeline Inn?
Assuming that hypothetical of Doric simplicity, no. So, for example, to take another example, suppose there were a rental company somewhere else in Fontana that managed the other condominiums and cleaned them and even rented them out for people, but they had nothing to do with the Abbey Resort. That rental company's office building wouldn't become more valuable because that's business income. It's not something that that rental company could transfer with its property. Here, if we sell, if you're the owner of the hotel and you sell the hotel property, you're selling the opportunity, the expectation of continuing to have this lucrative arrangement.
As to the use of that hotel property.
Correct.
Because if I understood your response to my question, it was only the income related to the use of that property, the Abbey property that's included in the assessment, not these management functions.
No, I don't think I've made that clear. It's the profit that the Abbey Hotel makes, that is the rental income it receives from the rental of the condominiums, less the expenses related to servicing the condominiums.
So some of that profit comes from the operation of this management part of it. Some of that profit relates to renting out the real estate.
The management fees are, it is not being paid a fee only for access. It is being paid a fee in part for its management services in, say, making the reservations. But those services go on at the hotel property, just as if you have on the hotel side of the business, some of the things that the hotel guest pays for might be regarded as services. If there's a concierge who makes a reservation at a local tourist attraction, that's a service too. But all of that income is counted in the income of the hotel. If you're valuing the hotel, you don't try to distinguish between an item that comes from services or not. Similarly, if you're valuing the hotel here, you don't try to draw a line between the part of the rental fee that relates to services and the part that relates to access in the hotel. It would be impossible to do that, and the hotel has not attempted to draw that line.
But if the hotel merely gave the services for renting out these condos, no use of its property, you would not include that income in the assessed value. That would be your Doric symbol.
Yes, and if the assessor did that, I think the assessor would be in error, because there is no reason to believe that that value was transferable with the hotel property on a sale of the hotel property. But in this case, there's ample evidence that the value is transferable, that the value would go to the buyer of the hotel and not be sold separately or disappear.
Some of the local hotels allow non-guests to use their swimming pool for yearly passes or daily fees. Is that included in the stream of income if you are valuing that hotel?
Yes.
For assessment purposes?
Yes.
Do I have it correctly when I say that your whole argument focuses on transferability? Can this value be transferred? As I understand your argument, if it can be transferred, then according to case law, it's inextricably intertwined. If it's inextricably intertwined, then according to case law, it appertains pursuant to 70.03. Am I correct in the way that I'm characterizing your argument and your focus?
Yes, but I would add one more thing. It's a factual question which the assessor found to be the case. It's not my saying that it's transferable, and Mr. Markovitz saying it's not transferable. The assessor found it to be transferable. The assessor explained in enormous detail to the Board of Review why the assessor included that income in valuing the hotel. And the only question on that point really is whether there's substantial evidence to support the assessor's finding, which was adopted by the Board of Review. So we're into a question not of an abstract legal issue of what's on-site or off-site, but a question of whether there's substantial evidence. Now, if you want to go down a slippery slope, try erecting a line between what's on-site and off-site and see how many cases come here asking you to decide what is on-site and what is off-site. I'm sure we can imagine many hypotheticals. Let me give you one. Supposing the Abbey decided that it would condominiumize every single one of its hotel rooms and make each hotel room a condominium. Would each hotel room then be off-site so that the revenue from those hotel rooms would be excludable in valuing the hotel? I don't think so.
Mr. Horowitz, you benefit here by a presumption of correctness from the assessor's determinations?
Absolutely. Not only a presumption of correctness on the part of the assessor, but a presumption of correctness on the part of the Board of Review. It is up to the owner here to show that there was not substantial evidence or that there was some error of law. And that is what the owner here has not shown. The owner doesn't really claim that there wasn't substantial evidence. The owner is only claiming here that there was an error of law. And if the transferability is the heart of my argument, then the heart of the owner's argument is this distinction between on-site and off-site. That is all there is to the owner's argument, this abstract distinction that since the condos are a separate property, anything that relates to the condos should not be counted in income from the hotel. But the income that the hotel receives is not just from renting a place to sleep. It's not just from managing the condominiums in the strictest sense. That's what makes it inextricably intertwined with the hotel. People rent condominium villas because they're at the Abbey Resort. That's the way they're advertised, that's the way they're sold, that's the way they're marketed. That's why people rent them in the first place. And not only do I say that, but that's what the Court of Appeals found. That's more importantly, that's what the assessor found.
Could I inquire, when is it that that presumption no longer exists? The Court of Appeals, as I recall, did say that the determination
Court of Appeals said that rounding up was an error of law, that the assessor was not entitled to round up at least to that degree. It was about 2%. So the presumption does not apply where there's an error of law, but if it's a factual question, and indeed whether the condominium income is inextricably intertwined with the hotel property, that is a factual question. Where it's a factual question, then there's a presumption that the assessor was correct. And somebody has to come along and prove it otherwise. It's a question of who has the burden of proof there. And coupled with that is the substantial evidence rule. As long as there's substantial evidence from which the Board of Review could have reached its conclusion, that factual conclusion by the Board of Review must be affirmed. And that's
your position would be there are no errors of fact from the assessor.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Your position is there are no errors of fact in the assessor's assessment.
That's correct, and no errors of law either, because the assessor did what the assessor is supposed to do, decide whether the condominium income is transferable with the property and is inextricably intertwined. The assessor expressly did that, expressly relied on the NS Associates case and the waste management case, and expressly explained in great detail, both in his testimony and in an exhibit, why the assessor reached that conclusion. So it's really the answer to the if the question of are we embarking on a slippery slope is no. What we're doing is we're letting the assessor make the factual determination, and if there's substantial evidence to support the factual determination, then the assessment will be affirmed. That's what is common to do in factually based questions about assessment. So there's nothing extraordinary here about this case that requires a change from the substantial evidence rule. There is no error of law involved here.
You're here to us supporting the result of the Court of Appeals.
Absolutely.
And you're familiar with the opinion. Is there anything in this opinion that you would change that would not change the bottom line? Any discussion here you think is not appropriate or fully helpful to the council?
I would change two things. The Court of Appeals seems to be under the incorrect impression that it decided the waste management case and refers to this court deciding it. I would change that.
That I thought.
And then in one of the footnotes I discovered yesterday, it refers to a case and refers to the realtor, and it meant the relator. Other than that, I think the Court of Appeals decision is just fine.
I didn't catch that.
There are a couple of things I change in my brief, and I filed a motion to correct the brief. And the main thing I change is that the word processing system ate five lines of my last page. And so I filed a motion to correct that, and I have that page if it's available here, if it would be more convenient for you. It's the very last page with the signature on it. And there's a gap between the end of the the end of the quotation on the previous page is missing and the beginning of the quotation on the last page is missing. And if you wish, I can distribute that page to you.
To give it to the Deputy Marshal.
Thank you. Yes?
Justice Brad.
Would you address the double taxation, uniformity clause, unitary tax rule, please?
Yes. There isn't any double taxation here. First of all, it would be the burden on the owner to prove that there was double taxation. There's absolutely no evidence in the record about how the condominiums were assessed. We don't know if the condominiums were assessed by sales comparison method, by recent sales, by the income method, or whatever. But let's assume for a minute that the condominiums are assessed on the income method. A renter of a condominium pays $100 to rent the condominium for one night. Actually, it's a little more than that, but I round it off for simplicity if I'm still permitted to round off. $50 goes to the hotel. $50 goes to the condominium owner. If you're valuing the condominium by the income method, you take the condominium owner's $50 and put it on the condominium owner's income statement. You take the other $50 and put it on the hotel's income statement. There's no double taxation here, even if both properties, the condo and the hotel, are valued by the income method. Now, as far as uniformity of taxation,
I had the impression, maybe I'm wrong, that they did not use the income method for the condominiums. You're saying it was just unknown?
It's just not in the record. But let's assume they did. There still would be no double taxation because the assessor presumably would only count in the condominium valuation the condominium owner's net income, $50 out of $100, just as the assessor counted in the hotel income the other $50. In each case, it would be less expenses if you're figuring out things by the income method. So there isn't any double taxation here. There isn't any lack of uniformity of taxation here because there's no evidence that there is any discrimination between the valuation of the condominiums and the valuation of the hotel. There's no evidence that the hotel is valued in a way that violates the uniformity clause, and there couldn't be any evidence without any evidence of how the condominiums are assessed. There isn't any evidence about the how the condominiums are assessed. And as far as the idea that there is a unitary taxing rule, that's just another way to make the same argument that there's a conceptual distinction between on-site and off-site, and this income is off-site when in fact only part of the rent is paid for use of the space within the condominium. The rest of the rent of a condominium guest is paid for use of the hotel. 50% of that rent goes to the condominium owner. 50% of it goes to the hotel. Now, that's a negotiated price. But that's the economic reality. That's the fee that the split that was negotiated. And that's why the assessor counted 50% of that gross rent in the hotel's income for purposes of valuing the hotel. And that's why the Court of Appeals decision should be affirmed.
Are there any other questions? Hearing none, thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Ms. Roshke, you have 5 minutes for the settlement.
Thank you. I have just a few comments. I'd like to start with the premise that we have fairly limited precedent in Wisconsin. We have the Greendale case and waste management. And we're kind of taking a round hole and trying to fit this square peg case into it. And frankly, I don't think those cases were ever written with a contemplation of this type of a fact situation arising and having to be dealt with under them. Personally, I don't find the phrase inextricably intertwined to be all that helpful. But I do find a lot of the nuggets that are in waste management and a few from the Greendale case to be very helpful. The respondent kind of omitted to address waste management very thoroughly by saying we used an income approach, so all the tests in waste management don't apply. But I think we can get a lot of illumination from that case, starting with the premise that there is a difference between going concern value and real property value. In addressing Justice Abramson's question, is the hotel property more valuable because of this income stream? The going concern of the hotel is more valuable, but the real property is a different item. The real property is not intangibles. The real property is not personal property. The real property is not more valuable because of this income. But the going concern would be someone would sell the business for a bigger price than they might sell without this income. But that's because it's attributable to management expertise and labor and skill that's been developed over time by ABCA.
Well, if it was sold as a business and then the assessor came in to determine it, what would he use as the value of the property?
I think they start with what's reported on the transfer tax return.
So it would be the selling price.
No, you don't report the entire sale price on transfer tax return. Between the buyer and the seller, they would allocate what was real property, what was personal property, what was intangible.
But, counsel, you are stipulating that the income approach is a valid approach here.
Yes.
You are stipulating that for purposes of assessing real property, the income approach in this case is a valid approach.
Yes. But that doesn't mean that you don't look at some of the other items out of waste management which are helpful, the main one being what is the source of the income. The source of the income, is it land? Even in Greendale, the court always emphasizes value attributable to the underlying land. I mean, I think we have to be thinking about the dirt and the bricks and the mortar as opposed to management skill and expertise. Waste management makes it very clear we don't want to be capturing in a real property assessment improper business and management income. And what's confusing here is that the income kind of changes nature as it passes through its various hands. When the condominium renters pay rent to the condominium owners, it's rent. But when that same dollar bill is paid to ABCA, it's not rent any longer. It's a fee for services rendered. When I earn income in my employment, and then I pay taxes with the same dollar, I'm not paying income to the government. I'm paying taxes. So just because it's once rent doesn't mean it's always rent.
But
I think that's a confusing item here.
But once you've stipulated to the income approach, that means income that, I think it means, I'm asking this, that ABKA gets can be included. No, that's not right.
No, income related to the real property.
That is inextricably intertwined with the real property.
If we have to resort to that phrase, yes. I would say income that's related to the underlying land and not income that has to do with management expertise.
Well, if you are an owner, if you are the owner of the condominium, are you saying that then the assessor should assess based upon 100% of the rent that is received?
I would assess on an income approach if I were doing an assessment of the condominiums on an income approach.
Yeah, but wouldn't you object?
I would,
if you were the owner of the condominium, wouldn't you say, hey, I didn't get 100%, I got 50%?
You would never. If I own an office building and I receive $100,000 a year rent, I am never assessed based on that $100,000. I'm assessed on the net income. You take out my expenses for heating the physical plant, for maintenance, for repairs, for taxes, whatever. That's all cut out. You do an income approach on net income. Those condominium owners would never be assessed on the entire rental paid. They would have that management fee deducted right off the top.
So somehow then this 50% that goes to APCA would just slip through the cracks.
As any expense.
It sounds to me like you're saying that condominium owners don't have to pay it. They only have to pay approximately 50%. The assessment is based upon 50%. NAFCA doesn't have to pay it because it's, well, for all of the reasons.
I don't think it's escaping any more than any expense would ever escape in a tax in a income approach analysis. When I pay a cleaning service and that comes out of my income stream, that income stream, nothing is escaping. You're just taxed on net income.
But some of it clearly is income to APCA. I mean, it's not all management services or cost of telephone. Some of it's going into their pocket.
Well, the one item I might clarify is, again, the confusion, the semantics, what's rental, what's management services. When those condominium renters are on the physical property of APCA, it's a pay-as-you-go basis. You don't play tennis for free. You don't eat at a restaurant for free. You don't go to the spa for free. There's a line item on their operating statements for other income, for restaurant income. That's been captured, and they're paying real estate taxes on that already. And I don't know that that has been clarified at all. My warning light's on already.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That ends our first case. The court is in recess until 2 o'clock, and we will hear the second case. Thank you.